Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month's episode is all about well-being. A few years ago on the podcast, we covered the mental health of both patients and optometrists. It's worth scrolling back to these episodes for a refresher. They're episode numbers 24 and 26. Ahead of 2025's World Optometry Day in March, we've decided to put optometrists front and centre again, this time to focus on stress and burnout. Next month, we'll examine the physiological impacts that long-term stress can cause too. We all know what stress feels like when it's extreme, but it may not be so easy to recognise if we're living with it day in and day out. Prolonged stress can lead to burnout, which can have severe consequences on both our personal and professional lives. What should we watch out for in ourselves and in our colleagues to make sure that stress doesn't become the norm? And how can we avoid getting to that burnout stage in the first place? Later on, I'll be joined by Dr. Nicholas Taylor, a consultant psychiatrist based in Leicestershire.
It's important that the actual problem, the core problem in the workplace, is solved and addressed, because otherwise, when they're back at work and the problems have recurred, they'll become ill again.
But first, to lay out the groundwork for this episode, I'm joined by optometrist and friend of the podcast, Neil Retallick. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Michelle.
For listeners who haven't heard you on the show before, tell us who you are and what you're up to now.
So my name's Neil Retallick. I'm an optometrist. I currently work for Specsavers as a head of professional development. I also do some assessing and examining for the College of Optometrists, but I'm also completing a PhD in the mental welfare amongst optometrists.
So Neil, I think we've probably all experienced stress before, but how does it tend to affect our lives?
So I mean, everything's a spectrum, and a little bit of stress is actually healthy for us. It can focus our mind and it can make us have that competitive edge. However, too much stress, of course, can be disabling and can really impact quality of life. You know, in the severest forms, obviously, it can lead to, you know, suicidal thoughts. But there is a difference between stress and anxiety, because stress is normally situational and we can overcome it with the right mindset. Whereas when you get into anxiety and some of those other conditions, you just don't have that belief that you can control it yourself. And that's where it becomes much more worrying, because people really struggle.
So Neil, we know that stress is really important and also important in optometry, but there hasn't really been much in the way of research on this topic, has there?
Surprisingly, there hasn't. There was one major study done in Australia of 500 optometrists in 2019, and they found, you know, nearly one in three optometrists have some form of issues mentally, and nearly half of them were experiencing some level of burnout.
Do you think we should have a greater awareness of stress and the risk of burnout?
Absolutely. I mean, healthcare professionals are more at risk than the general population because of the conditions we work in. Even in our research, we're in the early stages of doing the analysis. It is indicating very similar findings to Australia, that it is higher than the general population. We're finding similar, you know, around the one in three mark. But also we need to be aware of it because our patients are experiencing it more. So roughly about one in five or one in four adults are experiencing some level of stress or anxiety. So it is more commonplace. But there's also been a link to patient care. So if we're more burnout or not performing as well, then of course we're not giving the best service we should to the patients. And as well, it'll have an impact on us both emotionally and physically as well.
Did the studies that you've looked at provide any more details on who is more likely to suffer?
Yeah, we found the usual trends, like they have across all healthcare and in fact in general, that women seem more prone than men, younger, and were more at risk. But what surprised us was actually the significantly higher levels in those in study, so the pre-reg optometrists. And that's an agreement. For example, in nursing, they say that it takes almost 2 years to embed yourself within your career and for those levels to drop down. So it'll be interesting to see in optometry how things change as you become more experienced.
And why do you think younger optometrists are more affected by stress? Because I would have thought that as you progress through your career, the pressures are sometimes greater, particularly if you start to take on more mentoring roles or managerial roles.
if you look at some of the models out there that try and explain these things, there's a job demand to control model. And obviously when you're earlier in your career, you've got less control or autonomy over your work. So I think there's an element there. Of course, you're still new and there could be the fear of more risk of litigation. You've not formed a stronger working relationship because we know how important that is with your peers and management. And of course, the support network around you.
So you're trying to emulate the Australian study in the context of the UK and Ireland, and you ran your survey for 3 months last year in 2024. How did that phase of the study go?
Well, I think we hit a nerve, so to speak. You know, we got a really good response rate in terms of, I think people have welcomed, you know, some research into this because we were aiming, like you said, to simulate that study and get, you know, at least 500 responses. We actually had 1,600 people respond. Wow. And not only did they fill in the questionnaires, which of course are validated so we can do comparisons, but we had open comment boxes at the end, four questions there. And those were getting about 1,000 comments of people free typing in their views and opinions on these topics. So we've got a whole wealth of data, far more than we expected. So we're going to be able to do much more sub-analysis against certain population groups and comparisons than we even dreamed to do initially.
And we've talked about stress, particularly in the workplace for optometrists, but did you find any particular triggers for burnout?
Yes, so we looked at burnout as well. So we chose a questionnaire. I really like it, actually, because it's called the Copenhagen Burnout Inventory, and it splits burnout into three main areas. So personal burnout, work-related burnout, and patient burnout or client, depending on your profession. What we're finding, a bit like other studies in healthcare, is the work burnout's the highest, then personal burnout, and patient burnout was actually quite a bit lower. So it's not necessarily the patients that are causing us to burn out, it's other things.
And from the data that you've got so far, what are the questions that you are really interested in exploring now? Because you've got this extra data that you can look at.
Yeah, well, it's again trying to identify any risk factors or where we can look at interventions. So we also looked at lifestyle elements, you know, how healthy are people, you know, are they exercising, are they not? We asked, are you bullied, you know, have you taken time off work? But also, we really want to keep people healthy and happy in the workplace for longer. So we asked, what's the likelihood of you leaving and all of those things. We looked at change management questions. So we should get some really good stuff out of it.
Yeah. So with that extra information, what impact do you think you would like your research to have on the profession?
Well, hopefully we can produce some guidance that will be taken on board by individuals, by employers, and also the profession and other organisations. So, for example, it might be that the NHS take this and not just apply it to optometry, but further across other healthcare professions as well. What would be the icing on the cake is if we can find an intervention, test it and see how effective it is. Because a lot of the stuff out there in the research, people are doing things, but they don't really measure the difference that that makes.
So it's applying an intervention and then reading the questionnaire and seeing what the levels of stress potentially might be.
Yeah, and working with people to look at how that can be tailored, because optometry is a very unique profession. You know, we've got a retail element, we've got a clinical element, and we're interacting with the public and patients. And we've got to make clinical decisions sometimes on our own. So there's a lot going on.
What kind of workplace interventions do you think might be the most useful for optometrists who might be struggling at the moment?
Well, the good thing is in our survey, we asked a very broad question. What do you personally do to manage work stress? And what do you think employees can do? So make sure they get their breaks, make sure they form the right relationships, but also what they do outside of work. And there's multiple benefits from exercise. People do talk about yoga, meditation, and any form of relaxation. Breathing techniques is common as well. But what came out surprised me was there's only a few people who have actually sought professional support. So it's to make sure people feel comfortable seeking help if they need it, you know, from professionals or other organisations. But also from an employer point of view, what came up strongly was that people want to be listened to. Do they put time aside to catch up, you know, about how they can work together as a team and those wider aspects, daily huddles? What you've really got to do is address the root cause. Otherwise, are you going to move that needle? And what I was surprised at in the study is it's not one thing, it's different for everyone. So you can't have a blanket approach. You need an individual approach, an organisational approach, and some things that the profession need to do too.
I mean, I guess it's thinking about what actually makes you stress on your day and does it happen on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think in work, it's about the workload, and outside of work, it's about make sure they get that balance between work and life. People were saying, look, I just need to be more disciplined. You know, I need to silence my work apps at 8 p.m. or, you know, I need to make sure I leave work on time and don't take everything home, and I can make sure I really maximize that time with family and doing the things that they enjoy. What people said was, I find the thing that works for me, and, you know, I always have plans, or, you know, I have a holiday book, so I have something to look forward to, you know, and those little things.
That's where I'm going wrong, Neil. I don't have a holiday book.
You know, I walk my dog, you know, because it combines that with exercise. There's Headspace apps and certain guidance, things that people can download that give them support that way as well. And people have said, just even the basics, like getting your sleeping right, makes a massive difference to your day. So, you know, there are ways to be cleverer, but we live in a very busy world.
So it's about using the resources that you have. I mean, in terms of professional support, I know that the College of Optometrists runs a wellbeing programme for pre-reg trainees and for optometrists that have qualified and are in their first few years of practice. And the AOP has something as well. They have their peer support line, which I think is a really good resource as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. If you've got a topic that you'd like us to cover, email us. The address is podcast@dockets.info, or use LinkedIn to message us here at Docket. There's a link in the podcast description. Next, I'm joined by Dr. Nicholas Taylor, a consultant psychiatrist who's the medical director at Forensic Psychiatry Experts. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me.
No, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So, Nick, I asked Neil this question, and I'll ask you. How would you characterise burnout?
Well, when people talk of burnout, I think most people think of work-related burnout. And in that setting, it's a situation that develops over time when people feel pressured, they feel stressed, and they feel increasingly tired, and it causes problems within the workplace. And if they don't manage it properly, the situation can deteriorate.
In your psychiatry practice, how often do you come across healthcare workers facing these kind of challenges?
For me, people with burnout actually rarely come and say, I think I've got burnout. They will say, I'm feeling low, I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling tired, I'm struggling at work. And they usually feel that it's a problem, like a depressive illness or an anxiety-related illness. And underlying that, it's often burnout, and the depression or the anxiety is almost a symptom of the actual problem.
So patients don't necessarily present knowing they are burnt out. So how do they present themselves to you in your practice?
These days I'm in private practice, so I see a lot of young professionals who are struggling, often in the early stages of their career, trying to find their place in the workplace, really, and in their life, and they're finding it difficult. They're often people, in my experience, who are prone to a degree of low mood or anxiety, and when they encounter problems at the workplace, then the real pattern of burnout can emerge.
And so I guess there are both physical and mental health impacts of this type of stress.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about managing it. So the main mental health problems are a degree of anxiety and a feeling of tiredness, sometimes a reluctance to go to work or a reluctance to accept the full burden of work properly. And compassion fatigue is often part of that. And on the physical side, clearly, if this situation is allowed to develop and goes unmanaged, it can develop into all sorts of problems. People can find themselves drinking a bit more than they were before, and they can feel a degree of hopelessness at times and lack of motivation. So that can impact on the level of exercise that people do. And that, of course, can bring its own physical healthcare problems in time.
You've mentioned that anxiety or depression can almost be a symptom of burnout. But how is burnout actually related to those mental health conditions?
People with a history of anxiety and depression are at more risk of burnout. But I think a much stronger link is that when people develop burnout, their risk of other psychiatric conditions goes up very significantly. Problems such as depressive disorders and anxiety. And if people have had those in the background or had those dormant for some years, then burnout can reactivate them really and bring on another episode.
Going back to the workplace environment, you mentioned compassion fatigue. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that?
Yes, I think all healthcare professionals want to do their best for their patients, and we hold our patients in positive regard, and we want to look after them and provide them the best level of care. And I think when healthcare professionals particularly experience burnout related to work, They lose confidence in their own ability to deliver the best care. The motivation ebbs away, and they can find themselves going through the motions rather than going the extra mile to look after their patients.
And what group of people are more likely to suffer burnout in the healthcare workplace environment?
In my experience, although I normally see young professionals, I think burnout develops in the mid-career to late career, really. In your early career, it's still quite exciting and new. You're training, you're developing your skills, there's a sense of progression. And often trainees in lots of fields within healthcare are protected from the real pressures that affect the more senior people. And in my experience, once people almost plateau in their mid-career or late career, they've finished their training, they've settled into a role, and the routine of that begins to impact them. It can become, in any job, slightly monotonous. And I think at times of greater stress, particularly times of greater commercial pressure, if people are not well supported by their organisations or their colleagues, then that's the time of risk, really.
So you mentioned that in your practice, you see quite a lot of younger professionals, but yet it's the older professionals that are more likely to suffer from burnout. So do you think there's a greater awareness in younger professionals and are more open to talk about it, whereas people of perhaps our age just think they're going to tough it out?
I do. I think it's well recognised, isn't it, that younger people are more open to talking about their mental health difficulties, and there are more support structures more readily available to people earlier in their career. Whereas once you reach a more senior level, people have a sense, oh, I've seen all this before, I know what I'm doing, I don't need the support, I don't need the help, I'm just going through a rough patch. And I think there's a temptation then, partly to keep themselves in their professional position without looking vulnerable, there's a temptation to sort of press on and, as you say, tough it out, which can lead to a delay in recognising that things are going wrong. And of course, once they start to go wrong, if you don't respond by putting sensible measures in place, then things can go downhill. And if people keep that to themselves, they're heading for trouble, really.
What do you think are the factors that might lead to burnout in optometrists or any healthcare provider?
I think there's a range of factors, really. First of all, it's important to recognise that optometrists have a significant burden of responsibility caring for patients. It's stressful. It's about diagnosis. It's about flagging up issues, referring people on when necessary, and, of course, dealing with the patient themselves. And alongside that, in a healthcare business, as it were, there are other pressures as well. There may be financial pressures, pressures to see a certain number of patients, maintain a level of throughput. And I think in any healthcare profession, that's sometimes at odds with the need to respond to individual patients and see them thoroughly and properly. And a real risk factor for burnout is when you don't feel that your employers or your work environment are giving you time to do the job properly. If you find yourself staying late at work, working more slowly than other people think you ought to, then that places at greater risk of burnout and greater stress.
So it really can affect how we actually care for patients as well, can't it?
Yes, and I think the effects on the individual practitioner are quite significant, but it certainly brings risk to patients. We all want to get up in the morning and go to work to do our best for our patients and our colleagues. If burnout gets to the stage of compassion fatigue, when people are going through the motions, simply ticking the boxes and moving on to the next patient without being thorough and keeping their eyes open for potential clinical risks and situations, then, of course, the risk to patient care comes in and people will miss things.
Yes. So how do you think burnout may actually affect our judgment when it comes to clinical decision making?
When people have burnout, they switch off to some extent and they think, oh, it'll be all right, we'll just move on to the next patient, just let's get through the afternoon. And that's when risks can go unnoticed.
Do you think practitioners can go the other way? They become overcautious because they've lost confidence?
Absolutely. And certainly I've seen that in my professional practice. That often happens, I think, when people have missed something in the past and they don't want to make that mistake again, and they are overcautious. And that, of course, brings its own stresses, because if you're in that frame of mind, your anxiety levels rise and your practice will become noticeable. You might flag up on various systems for referring too many patients, taking too long, and so on.
So at what point, as healthcare professionals, do you think we might be required to tell regulatory bodies such as the GOC or the GMC that burnout might be affecting us?
I think it's important to act before it gets to that level, really. And any healthcare professional who's supervising colleagues and providing training needs to keep a proactive eye out to look at the earliest signs of burnout developing and nip it in the bud. There's no single red line that, if crossed, means that you need to notify your regulator. But I think if you consider that your practice is impaired, that you're not able to do your job fully and provide high quality care for patients, then it's important to raise it. But I think there are steps before that as well, which are important.
So I think what you're saying is prevention is better than cure. And I think that's where regular one-to-ones is really helpful, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think a problem shared is a problem halved. If you've got a sympathetic manager that you can talk to who understands the pressures of your work and perhaps the wider pressures in people's lives as well, then that can be really helpful in managing the level of stress and anxiety exposure in individual members of staff. And it's important that adaptations are made to an individual's work to prevent all sorts of mental health problems and physical health problems, not just burnout.
Yes, I think when someone is suffering from chronic stress or potentially on the verge of burnout, there are other signs, as you said. They may be ill more often at work, so they may have to take days off. So yes, the clues are there for us to look out for as managers as well. Is there ever a right time to broach this with a colleague? Is there a polite and non-confrontational way of asking about a colleague's mental health?
I think there are, and I think that's increasingly straightforward these days, much more so than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And I think, again, it's not about waiting until the problems are in front of you. It's about having regular catch-ups and regular discussions about stress and how people are feeling. Because if you're talking about these things when there is no problem, it takes the stigma out of it and makes it easier to raise the same questions if there might be a problem.
And if a colleague does open up to us and tell us that they are struggling, what should we do as colleagues or managers? What resources are there out there?
The first thing to do is to make them feel validated and explain that you appreciate that they're having difficulties. And most important is not to do anything that might make them feel that you're dismissing their concerns. And then clearly there are a wide range of options for assistance. So is there anything that can be done just immediately at a local level to change the working practice, change the working hours, add a degree of flexibility, just ease the burden a little bit? Some people benefit hugely from time away from work. I've known colleagues and patients who've had a short sabbatical and they come back refreshed, ready for years of happy working life. Going beyond that, of course, there are the more formal avenues of things like sick leave away from work, if it's got to that level, and then really a wide range of support structures and organisations accessible often via the GP.
Well, currently at the moment, patients do tell us that it's very difficult to get hold of their GP. If a patient feels that they can't get through to their GP very well, what are the options for self-referral?
I think it depends on whether somebody has private healthcare insurance, because if they do, the options are wider and, of course, more quickly available. Certainly, I see a number of patients who will simply ring their private healthcare insurer and say, look, I think I need to see someone. And that often leads to a triaging appointment with a healthcare professional who can signpost to either a therapist or a psychiatrist if there's some question of mental illness. And that opens the door to further support, really.
And if they don't have private health insurance, you know, because not all optometrists will have private health insurance, where can they find a triaging service like that?
It is difficult in those circumstances, and I think the GP has an absolutely key role in this. And as you say, it can be difficult to have a GP appointment, but many people see their GPs moderately often for appointments every few months, and it can be introduced into that sort of appointment and discussed there. Failing that, I would say it's important to contact your GP and let them know that you do need an appointment and you don't want to wait weeks or potentially a month or two for that. It is important.
Once a patient does get to see the appropriate professional, how do you manage patients who have extreme burnout? or have reached that level of burnout?
I think it depends very much on what problems that has spiraled into and caused. If it's purely a work-related issue, and it rarely is, there are normally aspects of the home life or alcohol use or something else which contribute to it. But if it's purely work-related, then changes at work should help. So developing a shared understanding with colleagues and managers about what changes are needed in the longer term. If, though, the burnout has triggered other mental health problems, such as a depressive illness or an anxiety-related illness, I think two things are needed. People need treatment for that separate illness, which could be with one form of talking therapy or another, or it could be with medication, such as antidepressant medication. But together with that, it's important that the actual problem, the core problem in the workplace, is solved and addressed as well, because otherwise they can be treated successfully for the depressive disorder. But actually, when they're back at work and the problems have recurred and run on again, they'll become ill again.
Mm. So we've talked a lot about what employers can do and what colleagues can do to help. But people also have to help themselves as well. So can you make any suggestions as to what we can do to help ourselves in the workplace?
It's easy to say this, of course. It's difficult to take your own medicine sometimes in these respects, isn't it? It's all of the things that I'm sure every listener is familiar with, but that many people struggle to put into practice. So it is issues like having a productive, happy life outside of work whenever possible, and a work-life balance. If you're working too many hours, if you're worried about work and thinking about work when you're away from work on your days off or your holidays, that's a real sign that there's an issue. So it's making sure you get time outside, making sure you get some exercise as much as you're able, eating healthily, making sure you're not drinking too much alcohol. All of these things that we've all heard 1,000 times and we're all familiar with, but perhaps struggle to apply consistently every day.
So you remind me that actually, yeah, during the week this week, I actually had 0 reading on my Fitbit to say I had no cardio load that day because I'd been sat down in the office all day or at work all day.
Yeah, we know from personal experience and from the news and from our own training that when people take time to exercise, burn off the anxiety, get the cardio in, spend time outside, then the stress levels reduce, you sleep better, you cope better with things. But it's, as you say, it's difficult to do.
Yes. And are there any particular resources that you can recommend to optometrists that they can get for themselves?
I think one of the areas that I often suggest to people to cope with, particularly with anxiety, is associated with cognitive behavioural therapy, or CBT. CBT is a really good, really practical and accessible therapy for managing anxiety, which is a key part of burnout. CBT can be done really well with a therapist, but I think the evidence is fairly clear that it can be done just about as well from a book.
That's interesting.
Yes, it's true. And that a book that I have in my own house, which I've used for myself, is CBT for Dummies. I hesitate to recommend it to patients, and I always have to say, I'm not saying that you're a dummy, but it's, of all of the CBT books I've read and used with patients, I find it's one of the most comprehensive. And I think lots of people find at least some of the strategies in it helpful. Not all of them, but there aren't many people who could read it cover to cover and with goodwill and some enthusiasm and then say, well, that was a waste of time. It can help almost anyone.
Well, Nick, I shall go and look that book up now. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue to look at stress, and in particular, its physiological impacts, next month on Sound Optometry. Thanks for listening. Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for Sound Optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain 1 CPD point covering leadership and accountability and professionalism. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.